Thank you for agreeing to see me, Mr. Needlestinger.
I didn't agree to see you. And why is my secretary unconscious?
She'll be fine. That's a very short-acting type of chloroform.
I didn't get to be the biggest producer on Broadway by spitting on an upstart with Moxie. Okay, kid, pitch your musical.
It's about the American Revolution. Nobody has done that.
There's a big hit right now called Hamilton, kid.
Oh, I was in Ohio all summer.
On the other hand, people can't get tickets to that one. What's yours?
It's called Trumbull. It's all about Jonathan Trumbull.
Never heard of him.
That's a good one. Like, you never heard of the governor of Connecticut who ran the war office that handled all the provisioning of the Continental Army?
Humor me. So what kind of numbers are we talking about?
A big first act number called Yeah, We Got That. Do you need tents, pots, or beans? Do you need muskets and canteens? Or some tools to dig latrines? Oh, yeah, we got that.
That's terrible, kid.
How about the scene where Lafayette shows up at the war office and he sings Merci for the blankets? Thank Trumbull for all those socks. For all those socks kept frostbite far away. Thank Trumbull for salted beef. We had that stuff for breakfast every day.
Kid, I'm gonna stop you right there. If you sing one more note, I want some of that chloroform he gave Louise.
But Mr. Needlestinger...
You got no talent, kid. But you do have a finished musical about a very hot topic. We'll release it as Trumbleton. The tourists will never know the difference. All Romanian cast. They're very inexpensive. Now, get out of here.
It happened. I wrote a Broadway musical. I wonder if there are any other musicals at all anywhere. I wonder if there are any other musicals at all anywhere.
Stop that, kid.
Maybe just listen to this show about innovation in musical theater. And now he plays Gil Garcetti in the new Cato Kaelin musical, Colin McEnroe.
It's not that big a part, actually. But all right, so what are we talking about here today? Well, the Tonys are, in fact, this weekend. And yes, you're going to hear a lot more about Hamilton. And maybe you want tickets to Hamilton and you can't get it, but can't get them. And you also might be wondering, as everybody else in show business is, what's the next Hamilton going to be? And the reality is that whatever the next Hamilton is, and it won't sound very much like Hamilton at all, and it won't be about Jonathan Trumbull, it's probably happening right now someplace else. That most of the energy, the dynamism, the innovation that leads to something like Hamilton happens in other spaces. And in fact, if you were smart, or for example, if I were smart, I would have seen Hamilton at the Public, which is where it started. I did see Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson there. I just picked the wrong historical musical to go to at the Public. But as you wander around lower New York or out here in Connecticut or in New Jersey, or there are all these places where people are really experimenting with this form called the Broadway or the American musical, musical theater. And some it's often regarded as one of the purely American performing art forms. It's something that we kind of came up with. It's an extension of a lot of other things that preceded it, like light opera, but this is sort of our form. And it's constantly being tinkered with. And the people who create this stuff are constantly asking themselves questions all the time about, well, could this be a musical? Is this thing I'm doing even a musical? I mean, there's people talking, there's people singing. Is it still exactly a musical? How far can we stretch the form? And that just goes on all the time. And obviously, one group of people found a really good way to stretch it. But as you might have heard me say in the recorded intro before that, I mean, my father was at West Side Story on opening night, and people walked out of that and said, everything has changed now. The American musical will never be the same. And they were absolutely right, but that didn't mean that somebody else did West Side Story. Stephen Sondheim and Leonard Bernstein didn't even do anything like West Side Story after that. They did other things. So today we're going to be talking about the other things. So, yeah, the Tony Awards are this Sunday. They begin at 8 p.m. You're going to hear a lot about Hamilton, but there'll be other stuff as well. Meanwhile, you have lots of chances to go see interesting theater around Connecticut, and you're going to hear about other theater that you'll have to go a little bit further for. Let me tell you who's on the show today. In the studio with me is Forrest McClendon, actor and singer, nominated for a Tony Award himself for his role in Scottsboro Boys. He's also a teacher at the Eugene O'Neill Theater, and he's coming in to play in Peter and the Starcatcher at the Connecticut Repertory Theater. I should probably insert the fact that right now at the Connecticut Repertory Theater, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying is concluding its run, and my voice is the voice of the book. There's a book that talks to the characters, and it's me. So anyway, Cesar Alvarez is joining us from studios elsewhere. He's a composer, lyricist, artist in residence at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia and the artistic director of Polyphone at UA Arts. I hope I'm saying that right. César's musical Futurity won the 2016 Lortel Award for Outstanding Off-Broadway Musical. Joining us by phone is Don Stevenson. He's actor and director, currently visiting director for Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd at the Goodspeed Norma Terrace Theater, which is running through June 26th. I've seen it. You should see it. We'll be talking about why you should see it. So here we go. We're about to have that conversation. I barely know where to begin, but maybe the place to begin, since we're diving off the Hamilton diving board, maybe we should just very quickly, for those people who've never heard anything from it, let's just hear a little bit from Hamilton. This is Aaron Burr, sir.
Pardon me. Are you Aaron Burr, sir?
That depends. Who's asking?
Oh, sure. Sir, I'm Alexander Hamilton. I'm at your service, sir. I have been looking for you.
I'm getting nervous.
Sir, I heard your name at Princeton. I was seeking an accelerated course of study. When I got sort of out of sorts with a buddy of yours, I may have punched him. It's a blur, sir. He handles the financials.
You punched the bursar.
Yes, I wanted to do what you did, graduating too and join the revolution. He looked at me like I was stupid. I'm not stupid. So how'd you do it? How'd you graduate so fast?
It was my parents' dying wish before they passed.
You're an orphan. Of course, I'm an orphan. God, I wish there was a war, then we could prove that we're worth more than anyone bargained for.
Can I buy you a drink?
That would be nice.
All right. So, you know, Forrest McClendon, I was listening to a group of people on a podcast talking about Hamilton. They weren't theater people. They were political people. They'd been invited to come see the show. They're political journalists. And one of them said, I really like this show, although I kind of hate musicals. And I thought, well, that's not really that useful. But I was also thinking that probably means that the last musical you saw was like a high school production of My Fair Lady. So you think you hate musicals. And you think also that Hamilton represents a completely radical departure from the standard musical, which it sort of does and it sort of doesn't, right?
Well, I imagine that it does. I, like you, didn't get an opportunity to see it and wish that I had gone to see it.
You got a Tony nomination. You could just walk in there, I
think. It's crazy. You want to imagine that you can just wield the idea of a Tony and that somebody might give you something, but it really doesn't happen that way, Colin. So I didn't get a chance to see it. But what I think is interesting is that it's so iconic that I'm more likely to encounter it on The Late Show or on The View than I am to actually be able to see the show. So.
And César, I mean, in some respects, bending the Broadway musical or bending the form of musical theater is something that goes on all the time, sometimes by people who want to write something called musical theater, and sometimes by people who don't really know exactly what it is that they're trying to write, and it winds up being something that kind of approaches a musical. I think that was that closer to your experience with Futurity?
Well, it's funny that you were talking about people saying they hate musicals. I'm a composer by education and came out of experimental music, but also had a jazz training. And I was one of those people not, you know, maybe 8 years ago that was sort of like, oh, yeah, I'm not really that into musicals. But I thought, well, I'm a composer. Maybe I could write one that I like. And then when I started writing one and started actually investigating the form, I became sort of obsessed with it as a form. And I realized kind of how myopic my initial assessment of the form was, because it truly is, and as Hamilton illustrates really well, quintessentially American form that is a form. It's not a genre, and it can really become any number of things stylistically or story-wise. So, yeah, I kind of fell backwards into the world of musical theater, but I'm really pretty much spending every day trying to answer these questions about what's next for the musical and what is the musical capable of.
I think it might be helpful for each of you, and I'm going to start with you, Forrest, just to sort of give people a sense of where you're going to Peter and the Starcatcher. We can talk about that in a second. But people who haven't seen Scottsboro Boys, and if they know what that story is historically, it might be one of those examples where you'd think, really? A musical? And it is a musical and it isn't, right? I mean,
absolutely. I think that I, after many, many talkbacks, ended up referring to it as a minstrel show wrapped in a musical, wrapped in a play, because it was just so hard to identify what the form of it really was. But the interesting thing is, and I think about this all the time in storytelling, is I look at the story and then ask, what does the form really want to be? And with the Scottsboro story in particular, because it is so tragic, there were people who tried to dramatize it, make it into a straight play, and it just, of course, was 4 hours long and not particularly successful. successful. And I think that it was Susan Strom and John Kander, they landed on the idea of framing it as a minstrel show. And suddenly we had a vehicle for really being able to present this story. You understood why people were stepping out and breaking into song, for example.
Do you want to just quickly, we're going to play a little clip from Scottsboro Boys, but you want to just quickly, for people who don't know the historical record, explain what this is about?
Sure. It's about, well, a really tragic moment in our racial history where nine African-American boys were falsely accused of raping two white women in 1931 in Alabama. And the show really looks at the circus-like environment that their multiple trials generated.
Let's hear a little bit of this. Forrest McLennan, by the way, plays Mr. Tambo. And here's a clip from the Scottsboro Boys.
Every member of society celebrates our notoriety. Step right up and meet the Scottsboro Boys. Every communist throughout the land wants a volunteer to lend a hand. They all want to kiss the Scottsboro Boys.
When the first four got out, Leibowitz put them in Baldville. He hoped people wouldn't forget about the rest of us in jail. But guess what? They already had.
The Scottsboro Boys.
But me? I could never forget.
I kept hoping my life would begin.
I kept hoping my nightmares would stop.
One day I gave up hoping. I shot myself.
The Scottsboro Boys.
All right, giving you a sense of the kind of material that's being handled in a format that, I mean, it's not as though musicals have never been dark before. They have. There are all kinds of musicals that have. I mean, West Side Story is, you know, it's got a lot of very tough stuff going on in it. So, this is new ground that's being covered all the time. I think we're going to hold Cesar for last. We'll go to Don Stevenson next. Now, you've got a show up there right now, Roar of the Grease Paint. Apparently, it's at the Terrace Theater. There is no Norma Terrace anymore. Part of Good Speed Musicals Empire. This is a show that has existed once before, although we'd be here all day trying to explain the incredible track it took to the Broadway stage, where it didn't get to stay very long the first time around, which I think was 65. Was that when it was?
That's right. 1965 was when it was done on Broadway, and really hasn't been done in 50 years. You know, it really hasn't been done since then. And so no one knew it. No one knows it, except for the fact that it's got this incredible score of all of these hit songs, which everyone knows the song. They just don't know that they're from Roar of the Grease Paint, Smell of the Crowd. So, for example, Feeling Good is from that show. Who Can I Turn To? The Joker, Wonderful Day Like Today. So when I spoke to Leslie Brickus about doing the show, the composer, he said, you know, the songs have had a wonderful life, but not in the show. And so that was interesting to me to put them in their original context, how they were originally written. You know, I mean, songs in a musical come out of scenes or come out of dialogue. You go into the lyric and then you go back into a scene. And so we know these songs from, I think Feeling Good is being used right now on, I think, a Volvo commercial. And we've all seen Sammy Davis Jr. come out, you know, on some show and sing Who Can I Turn To? But you don't know the song in context of the show with the character of Cocky singing it. And so I thought that would be revelatory to examine and to rediscover how the songs were originally conceived in the shows, because everyone knows Sending the Clowns, right? And everybody's heard Frank Sinatra or other people sing that song. But if you're in a little night music and you hear the character of Desiree sing Sending the Clowns, it takes on a different meaning and has a different kind of resonance than it does if it's just being done as a standard. And so the thing that happened with Grease Paint was that most of the songs in the show became standards, but no one knew them in the context of the show. So that was one of the things that appealed to me doing it. And the songs were very accessible. Everybody knows them, and they're great, fantastic, you know, wonderful songs that'll rip your guts out. And so my goal became to try to make the show as accessible as the songs already were. And so that's what I tried to do, and that's what I wanted to do, to make the show like the song.
So what we've got here, and we're almost burying the lead, although there's two leads, and one of them is, yeah, this incredible repertoire that Anthony Newley had introduced to so many people. And, yeah, I was in sixth grade, and I stole my mother's copy of Sammy's Back on Broadway, where Sammy Davis does three of those songs, I think, on that album. But, I mean, what you've done is staged this in such a way that it's kind of, my description of it is, it's like if Lucky and Pazzo from Waiting for Godot staged a musical on a set they borrowed from the Mad Max movies. I mean, you've got this incredible sort of post-apocalyptic junkyard look with, you know, these people in rags and top hats and goggles and stuff like that, and in a way that really kind of bumps up, I guess, maybe even against people's preconceptions of the material. And just real quickly, Don, because I want to get you all talking to each other, but why did you make that particular set of choices?
Well, when I read the script, which I didn't know, like most people, there were all of these lines in the dialogue and lines in the lyric in the songs about waiting for the world to burn up. I preferred things the way they used to be, talking about war and destruction. And it led me to the idea of setting it in some kind of destroyed dystopian setting, and so that all of that would make sense, because the show was originally written, conceived as an allegory to the British class system, you know, sort of the have and the have-nots. And I thought, well, that doesn't really interest me, although it's certainly, you know, interesting historically. But I thought, you know, if you just turn on the news every day, we all see everything is about the have and the have-nots. And people working four jobs and not able to make a living. And I thought it had a lot to say about the United States and our world today.
Your show is basically now staged in year three of Donald Trump's first term.
I love that you see the political part of it, because I really thought that it had that as well. I thought it had a lot to say. And, you know, I think it was ahead of its time. You're talking about the form of musicals, and I think that Brickus and Newley, when they wrote the show in the 60s, it was ahead of its time. It took on these issues. It took on racism. It took on the have and the have-nots, the people that work hard and can't ever get ahead. And, you know, the game of life is the metaphor for the show. We all try to go forward four steps. You get pushed back three. And so I thought it had a lot to say about today, which is why I wanted to do it. And part of putting it sort of in the Mad Max setting, as you described, was to make it contemporary. I thought that that would be something that everybody would instantly recognize. I mean, Walking Dead is the biggest show on cable television. We all know Mad Max. And so I thought that would make it contemporary and new and fresh and really to invent an old show and make it seem brand new.
So, okay, we got to get to our third show here. And it's funny because Forrest and I were talking about Walking Dead before we went on the show today. But one of his co-stars from Scottsboro Boys is sort of the big star now on Fear the Walking Dead. But that's a whole other story. So, Cesar Alvarez, we got to talk about Futurity. This might be even harder to describe or explain to the audience than the first two musicals. But you said you fell backwards into the form. So give people a thumbnail. What is it we're talking about?
Well, my band, The Lisps, had been playing all over the country for quite a few years. We had done a few albums, and at a certain point, I had this idea about a Civil War soldier who was sort of really obsessed with science fiction, because science fiction had been invented right around the time of the Civil War as a result kind of the Industrial Revolution. And I thought this would be a really interesting storyline for my band to pursue, and as I started writing it, I realized it really wanted to be a fully fleshed out story. So me, someone who was a band leader and a computer musician, started composing a musical for my band, and really realizing how much fun it was and how much interest it created among my community. And so I followed that trail, and 8 years later, we finally got the thing off Broadway. We got a lot of really great recognition. We had an incredible time doing it, and it puts me into this conversation, which is, what is the Why do people love musicals so much? Why do people? Why is there such a sort of tortured relationship to the form? People love and hate them so much. And I, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that you look at Hamilton, but also a lot of, you know, the great sort of lions of the canon, like Cabaret and Rent and Hair and Chorus Line, Sweeney Todd, they're all actually really dark. They have really, really dark themes. And I think part of the reason that they're so effective is because music sort of allows us the safety to explore the darkest corners of our experiences. And it's kind of, and Scottsboro Boys is a great example of that, as is Hamilton, which is really the story of this tragic death of this incredible man. Music gives us this alibi to kind of stare down these really dark scenarios, and they involve so many people, the creating of them and the watching of them and the experiencing of them. It feels like there's this emphasis on community when you look at musicals. And so it'd be interesting to think about, well, when we think about what's the next Hamilton, well, what is it that Hamilton does so well? And what is the point of writing a musical at all? In this really troubled world that we're in. And as we saw in history, the musicals have done an incredible job of creating conversation around some of these really hard areas.
Yeah, it's a great point you're making. I mean, there are these truths that would be hard to speak, but somehow or other you can sing them. I mean, there's stuff for us in Scottsboro Boys, you know, that you really wouldn't want to say. Somehow or other you can sing it. I mean, Sweeney Todd, you know, you've got Mrs. Lovett singing about, you know, have a little priest, try a little priest. I mean, you know, you wouldn't necessarily want to say that. It's somehow or other it's both funny and dark and upsetting as you sing it all out. Well, we need to play a little bit of Steam Brain from Cesar Alvarez's Futurity. First of all, that is so much like, oh, what a beautiful morning. I'm amazed that the Richard Rodgers estate isn't suing the crap out of you, Cesar.
Yeah, it's really straight down the middle, isn't it? You chose a really wild clip, too. That's the moment in the – can I explain
that? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
moment?
Set it up. Yeah.
So the piece is about this soldier, this sort of lowly grunt soldier in the Civil War, who's trying to invent a machine that would at first, he has this idea of a machine that can think, and which eventually sort of the fantasy spins out into an idea that would actually be so intelligent it could end war. And so the whole piece is this exploration of imagination and sort of the futile act sometimes of imagination in the context of something as dark as the Civil War. And he collaborates with Ada Lovelace, this mathematician, in a completely fanciful and impossible way across space and time. And the moment you play it is the kind of culminating moment of the whole show, when the set has been peeled back and peeled back and peeled back to reveal this gigantic kinetic percussion set piece slash instrument, which designed by our percussionist Eric Farber and our set designers Emily Oerling and Matt Saunders, which is this insane culmination of his imagination. Of this artificial or sort of Civil War age artificial intelligence. So what you're hearing is this bizarre choral percussion cacophony that kind of ends in not so good for the soldier.
Ada Lovelace, who I think is a little bit the template for the female character in Arcadia, too. I mean, Ada Lovelace.
Yes, who I definitely – read that as research.
Yeah. It's essentially how we're kind of looking back at her right now. So, Forrest, one of the things that's worth talking about here a little bit is, you know, usually when people walk into a place, they have a certain set of expectations. So if they're like, I go to the New York Theater Workshop a lot, so I kind of know, you know, maybe I'm going to be a little bit challenged when I go there, or the public or wherever. I'm going to see the form stretch somehow or other. There are other places where you walk into and you probably expect something pretty straight ahead. If you're in line to see Waitress, yeah, you probably, you know, you're not expecting Steam Brain probably if you do that. But there are a lot of these places, right? I mean, the public's probably the most famous, but a lot of places that just function that way as incubators.
I totally agree. And it's funny, I think you said it earlier that for me, it's really everything below 14th Street.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a lot about the Vineyard. I think a lot about which is where the Scottsboro Boys began,
right,
specifically, because their places, the not-for-profit sector, is a place where you can really experiment and be quite dangerous. And so the most beautiful thing about being at a place like the Vineyard was we could find out exactly. I remember, as an example, being in my first coaching with John Kander, and he said, Forrest, there's something in this play to offend absolutely everyone, is the first note. And secondly, you couldn't possibly go too far. And that's not something you think about when you're thinking about getting to Broadway necessarily. Now, the show did have to, we had to cool a couple of those things off in order to land on the mainstream. But it is exciting to be in places like that where you can really find out, you can fully explore what the story is and how dangerous it wants to be. I think creativity is dangerous.
You know, you mentioned John Kander. So we should say, Scottsboro Boys was written by Kander and Epp. Probably, I think, their last musical as a team. But these are the people who wrote Cabaret in New York, New York, and The Happy Time. And these were two NYU grad students who are putting this thing on. And these were, you know, guys who really had succeeded at the existing form of the musical.
Yeah, and really gravitated towards the dark in absolutely everything.
And really, it is. Downtown is so great. There's another troupe called The Civilians, who they've produced at the Vineyard Theater, as well as, I think, at Barrow Street. And what they do often is collect a lot of sort of testimony from people and set it to music. In other words, they go around interviewing people about stuff, and then they build actual musical songs out of them. Another example of how the form can be stretched. But, you know, Don Stevenson, I think, you know, it's one thing to go to the Public or the Vineyard or New York Theater Workshop or probably the place in New Jersey that you're driving to right now where you're doing another show. You know, and then there are audiences that arrive with different expectations. So I was out there in the audience on opening night for you at Roar the Grease Paint. And so you've got some people who kind of get that Terrace is a place where new stuff is being tried out. And then you've got some pretty conventional Connecticut people and people who maybe don't see that many new musicals. And if they do, it's probably something pretty straight ahead. And so, like, even going into the men's room at intermission, like, half the people were kind of getting it. And there are other people who are really struggling with this, right? I mean, when you throw something at people who have a preconceived idea of what a musical is, for some of them, they're swimming upstream.
I think that's true, you know, and isn't that always the challenge, especially if you're running a regional theater, and I guess on Broadway too, you know, talking about Scottsboro Boys and all these other shows, is that people come in with expectations of what a musical is, or what kind of show it's going to be. And something like War of the Grease Paint and Scottsboro Boys and other ones, they're not going to be Oklahoma. They're not going to be Anything Goes. They're not going to be Guys and Dolls. And I love all of those shows, and I think they're wonderful, and I like to see them. And I have seen them, and I've done some of them. But you hope that there's room for everything, and room for shows to challenge and not necessarily spoon feed an audience every answer and not tie everything up in a nice bow by the end of the show and they all live happily ever after. I mean, certainly movies do that nowadays, and I always like that. I always like it when I feel like in a movie that the story keeps going and I go home and I'm thinking, what happened to those people and what's going to happen? And you feel like the story keeps going. It's not over. And there are no clear answers, because really that's the way life is, right? It's all sort of a shade of gray. And by the end of most days, aren't we all just sort of going, what happened to me today? What was that? And so I like shows that don't necessarily tie it all up for me, and then I go home and I'm still thinking about it. And I'm still talking about it. And really my hope for Grease Paint was for people to go out as they walk out to their cars in the parking lot and to still be talking about it and to still be thinking about it when they were home. It's evocative. And I think that there's room for that. I hope that there's room for that. And yes, you're right. I mean, there are people who want those kind of shows, and they should have them. They're great. But I hope that there's room for the other kind as well. And I hope that the people who think that they want the other will give something that's not quite as clear a chance. Because they may not know everything about it by the end, but I bet you they'll figure it out eventually.
All right. We're going to take a little break right now. Which song are we going out? Are we going out the... All right, we're going out with My Heart as a Drum. All right, because I think, are we still in the A segment of the show? Okay, so this is a song called My Heart as a Drum. It's from a musical about Ghana. The woman who wrote it was one of the winners of the Kleban Prize, which is like one of the really great musical innovation songs. So we just want you to hear some other stuff that's being produced in other places. You can't see this on Broadway. I think you had to see it in Washington. I don't know where it is now.
They cannot see all that it's meant for you. Deep inside you to decide what's true. Your heart is the drum.
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 Your heart.
We're talking about all the things that you can do with musical theater. And I figured out the connection to everything that just happened, which is that so the person who wrote My Heart is a Drum is Stacey Lutwak, who just won the Kleban Prize. But the Kleban Prize is actually two prizes. The other one went to Daniel Goldstein, who's directing Anything Goes, which was just mentioned in the previous segment, just upstream from Don Stevenson at the Goodspeed main stage. And it's a tremendous production, by the way, with a performer named Rashidra Scott, I think her name is, in the Reno Sweeney role, which is also very interesting. I mean, that was certainly intended to be an all-white cast back in the day of Cole Porter, and they've done some very interesting stuff with just the casting and performance of that. And she's amazing. You can't take your eyes off of her. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I want to talk a little bit, and our guests include, by the way, Forrest McClendon. He's an actor-singer nominated for a Tony Award. Tony Awards are Sunday night for his role in Scottsboro Boys. I mean, he's not up this year, but I mean, I'm tying the whole two things together. And he's a teacher at the Eugene O'Neill Theater, and he's opening very soon in Peter and the Starcatcher. Do you know what's opening night? Do you know?
June 23rd
at the Connecticut Repertory Theater out in Storrs. Cesar Alvarez is with us, composer, lyricist, artist in residence at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. His musical, Futurity, won the 2016 Lortel Award for Outstanding Off-Broadway Musical. Don Stevenson with us. He is currently the director of The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd, which is running through June 26th at Goodspeed's Terrace Theater. Cesar, you know, you said something really interesting. I mean, you said many interesting things in the first segment, but I want to jump in on one of them, which is that, you know, we do have this kind of ambivalent relationship with the musical. And there's this way in which it's a threshold, right? Like, if you're going to go see something that's not a musical, you're going to go see, I don't know, Clybourne Park, or you're going to go see Disgraced or something like that, you're sort of thinking, well, it's going to be a play and I'll probably like it. And if I don't like it that much, that's not that big a deal. There's some way in which... Like, I just went and saw Hadestown, which I just loved. This is Aeneas Mitchell's recasting of the myth of Orpheus, and somehow or other set to music that sounds kind of like from the Depression and trains and hobos and stuff like that. And I was just going in there thinking, I'm probably not going to like this. And so, Cesar, what is that? There's some sense that, like, musicals have to be sold to us harder than a straight-up play. I don't know why. Do you have a theory on why that is?
Well... You know, it's funny because musicals are sort of notoriously hard to produce, which is why at the Lortel ceremony the other day, they were saying, you know, there's 200 some plays up for Lortel Awards this year and 15 musicals. And it's shocking that only 15 musicals were produced off Broadway last year. And it's theaters are pretty terrified to produce them because... Even though they usually draw really well ticket sales, they draw really big crowds typically, it's just a lot riskier. And I think the shortage of wild, incredible, experimental, amazing new musicals, Broadway and off, isn't about a lack of artistry. It's more about a lack of sort of the will to put them on stage just because of a lot of sort of extra artistic concerns. So actually, I think people tend to love musicals and really want to go out to them, but there's a more tortured kind of commercial relationship with them and producerial relationship with them. Part of what I try to do is I talk a lot about how musicals aren't all one thing. You can have a musical that has one person singing a song. Cynthia Hopkins does an incredible job of that, where musicals don't have to be casts of 40, you know, and they could cost any variety of amount of money, depending. I just would love to see, you know, you look at the form of the musical, which is almost the exact same age as the form of cinema. And if you look at how widely cinema has been explored, and then you look at the musical and how it hasn't gotten that breadth of exploration with films. You can do, there's indie films and experimental films and documentary films and short films and animated films. And with musicals, there hasn't been as much of a wide understanding of how broad that exploration can be and that art form can be. And so, yeah, I mean, Hadestown's an incredible example of just a complete departure from what we would normally expect when we go see a musical. There's so many artists that are making that kind of work. It's really just about trying to create hopefully Hamilton and Fun Home, and another example, are creating a world where that kind of artistry is more possible and more visible.
I want to come back to that in just a second. And yeah, Hadestown is really great. I'm actually going to go see it again now, having sort of had some resistance that I don't even understand to seeing it in the first place. But Forrest, one of the other ways that gets dealt with, or it just gets expressed, I think, is like Peter and the Starcatcher, there's like people singing. But I don't know if I'd even think that. I mean, there's the ratio is off or something. There aren't as many people singing as there are in Carousel.
Well, it's the exact challenge that they had in terms of Peter and the Starcatcher. They didn't know whether they wanted to call it a musical or whether they wanted to call it a play or whether it was a play with music. I think they might have landed on the idea of it being a musical play, as it were. But along with that, I just want to go back to something Cesar was saying earlier that I think is fascinating about the work that he does, because I think there's a real role, as much as we see below 14th Street, new work being created like Hadestown that can potentially move into the mainstream. People like Cesar are curating festivals like the Polyphone Festival at UArts, and it really creates a bigger role for the academic community in terms of generating new work. What we think of as scholarship is really studying people who are dead, in my opinion, but it's really exciting when an institution can take a role in making something that is new.
You know, Don Stevenson, before you either run off the road or we have to let you go or something like that, I want to come back to something that you said, too, which is that there's something that happens in a musical that's different from, say, a review. Okay, so, there are some, for example, I think the thing that's following you into Terrace is a Petula Clark musical. I'm not sure exactly how that's structured or whether it has a script or whether characters sing stuff, but there's a lot of different ways to present music on stage, also at New York Theater Workshop, which is, by the way, I think also where Peter and the Starcatcher started, but I saw something called Backrack Reimagined, which really didn't have characters, but these incredible kind of, well, reimaginings of Burt Bacharach's music that were very affecting and effectively done. But there's something about the moment where a character speaks something and then translates that into a song that is different, right? There's an alchemy there that you just don't get any other way.
Right. Well, music is emotion, right? Music brings about emotion. You feel something. And so when a character sings, it's usually when their feelings get so big that the only thing left to do is to sing about it, right? I mean, and you can't just speak it anymore because you feel it so immensely that the only thing to do is to sing. And it brings about emotion. If you use music in a movie, you know, they use it strategically to manipulate the audience to feel certain things. I mean, you know, when you hear John Williams, ba-dum, 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 you know the shark is coming, right? And you get scared. So within a musical, it's the same kind of thing, you know. If you're singing a sad ballad, then the audience is going to feel that. And if you're singing, you know, some up-tempo thing that's going to make you feel inspired, then the audience feels that as well. And if you're singing from the character's point of view, the specific lyrics, then the audience comes and they see themselves up on the stage. They identify with the characters, this one or that one, you know, who are you? And how would you react in that situation? I mean, really, that's what the theater is.
We're going to take a little break here. I'm now getting some very great ideas for Jaws, the musical. I feel like you're going to need a bigger boat. That's how we end the first act, right? You're going to need a bigger boat. That's like the big song. All right. Forrest and I are going to work on that during the break. We're going to go out with some music that kind of sets up the final segment because, in fact, tomorrow there's the Polyphone Festival. There's all kinds of festivals. There's the Festival of Arts and Ideas down in New Haven, the Scottish production, which, once again, we'll have to be asking the question, is this exactly a musical or is it something else? But it's called Our Ladies of Perpetual Succor. It is opening there, I believe, tomorrow. There's a lot of buzz around this. You're going to hear a little clip from that show. I think they're singing Handel in this particular clip you're going to hear. Not typically associated with musical theater, but that's our whole point.
My heart is indicting. My heart is indicting. My heart is indicting. Indicting. Indicting of a good matter. I speak of the things.
Of the things.
I speak of the things which I have
missed. Coming up in Act 3, does everything have to be a musical? This may explain why my musical version of A View from the Bridge never got funded. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kion Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Leah Myers and Esther Shitu. The part of Bill Curry was played by Patty Lapone. For show pages, articles, and the original cast recording of Here and Now, the musical, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, The Nose gives you a whiff of the 8-hour ESPN O.J. Simpson documentary. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, this is something we've never done before. Not quite this way, anyway. So we've all been plowing through this 8-hour documentary, O.J. Made in America. And it'll be the whole discussion tomorrow. Anyway, right now we're talking about musicals. Forrest McClendon is in studio with us. I don't think I've even mentioned this. He's back home in a way, right? You're a UConn guy.
In every way. Born and raised in North Connecticut, UConn alum. So it's family all around.
So he'll be opening in Peter and the Starcatcher. He has already a Tony Award nomination to his credit for Scottsboro Boys. The Tony Awards, by the way, are on Sunday night. Cesar Alvarez is with us. And in fact, he's the artistic director of the Polyphone Festival in Philadelphia. And his musical Futurity won the 2016 Lortel Award for Outstanding Off-Broadway Musical. We're going to talk to Neil Murray in just a second. He's the executive director of the National Theatre of Scotland. Our Ladies of Perpetual Succor, which I just mentioned, is going to open tonight. It's tonight, I guess, at the New Haven Festival of Arts and Ideas. It's a co-production between the National Theatre of Scotland and the Live Theatre of Newcastle. But, you know, Cesar, since we've got you here and you've got that festival, do you want to mention maybe one musical that you've encountered either at the festival or someplace else this year that maybe an idea that people don't know about, something that somebody's trying that, once again, has that quality of both improbability and promise, a tinkering with the form of musical theatre?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you can actually see a musical, The Total Bent, which was on our first season, is at the Public right now,
right,
which is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, talk about a reimagining of what music can do in a story. It's really, truly amazing. And I also
quickly mention what The Total Bent is.
The Total Bent is it's a story of a father's son who are musicians in the 60s in Alabama. And one of them the son is the sort of brilliant songwriter who kind of departs and goes on a sort of Michael Jackson Prince route while the father is really has this sort of traditional soul music approach, which all is a cipher for a conversation about civil rights and racism and the really sordid history of both the South and the racial politics of the South, and as that was conversant with the music of the South in the 60s. So since, you know, this is an example of a musical which it's hard to pitch, it's hard to talk about, but when you see it, you don't need to talk about it. You just listen, and it's absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
The whole idea of Polyphone is essentially just to bring artists onto a campus, point our resources towards those artists, and allow the students to be their cast and creative team and support network so that they're learning how to be in musicals by being part of the next generation of new musicals. So it helps the artists, it helps the students, and it helps our form generate new and alternatively imagined work.
Okay, let's transition over to a new and alternatively imagined work. Neil Murray is joining us from Scotland. The show is opening in New Haven right about tonight and running through the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. And once again, Neil Murray, this is another musical or another concept that would be difficult to pitch. I've seen it described as more like a gig with drama, a musical gig with drama, than exactly a piece of musical theater. But in a nutshell, tell people what it is.
Hello there.
Hello.
Greetings from Glasgow. Well, it's based on a wonderful novel called The Sopranos, nothing to do with New Jersey mobsters.
Mm-hmm.
The Sopranos is a 1998 novel by the Scottish writer Alan Warner, which is the story of six schoolgirl sopranos in a school Catholic girls' choir going from Oban, this small town of Oban, which is a little port town in the Highlands of Scotland, to compete in a singing competition in Edinburgh, the capital. And whilst they are brilliant singers and their choir is very good, their mission for the day is basically to have the most raucous day out of their lives, which may include alcohol, it may include sex, it may include all sorts of things. And from that novel, the playwright Lee Hall, who wrote Billy Elliot most famously, that's Lee's really big statement piece. Lee Hall, as working with my company, the National Theatre of Scotland, has adapted it for the stage. So it's got so many different kind of avenues into it via the novel, via Lee's work, and the music itself is there's such a range of music in it. You just played the Handel piece. There are three or four classical excerpts, but it's also in the form of almost a rock gig around it, which uses the music of the 1970s and 80s British rock band, the Electric Light Orchestra, led by Jeff Lynne. So there's a lot of Jeff Lynne songs in there, which the girls sing. We have a female band on stage. There are nine women on stage, six actresses, three in the band, and they do the whole range of music from Mendelssohn and Bartok through to the Electric Light Orchestra and other music from that era. So it's a complete kind of original piece of work in some senses, although its origin is actually a novel.
Yeah, so it sounds a lot like Sound of Music, but with Electric Light Orchestra and more sex and drugs. So, I mean, Forrest, we have to end here. We're close to ending. But, I mean, you know, and I feel like we've been on this sort of incredible trip, and there's so many things that we haven't talked about so far. Do you have one more musical that you want to mention? Let's see, Cesar bring up one.
Oh, my word. Well, it's really interesting. I was saying before we got on the air that I'd worked on a musical called Annie Salem at Sundance earlier this season that actually ended up on the Polyphone Festival at UArts, which is this really crazy adaptation of a Mack Wellman novel where, long story short, you at the center of it is a sweet love story, but you come to discover that there's an intergalactic force that is the KKK that is trying to steal this thing called a Bojack so that the races won't be able to communicate with each other, the exact kind of thing that I think we might need in the era of Donald Trump.
Such an easy pitch. Such an easy thing to wrap your mind around. So, obviously, well, I think Forrest and I are both going to try to see how to succeed in business without really trying, which runs counter to everything we just talked about for 49 minutes. But and then he's going to be doing a Peter and the Starcatcher. Meanwhile, Cesar Alvarez has got all kinds of stuff going on down at the Polyphone Festival. Find out about that. Arts and Ideas is starting right now. You got to go see those girls from Glasgow. You're going to be very, very busy. And Roar the Grease Paint. You got to do that before it closes. And then if you want to do something really traditional, go see Anything Goes. Or if you want to see what a Disney musical looks like before it gets to Broadway, you can go see Anastasia at the Hartford Stage Company. And the money's all there up on stage, believe me. You can see it all. This is Jason Robert Brown's song. He's one of the last guys writing the old-fashioned kind of musicals.
Okay, Mr. Needlestinger, here's one more idea for a musical.
Kid, I don't get it. What is this? What are you doing here?
It's Mime the Musical.
Sold!